Hi, and welcome to Beyond Madness from me, Christopher Paul Sabo. As a psychiatrist, I host conversations about issues emanating from psychiatry that impact society, as well as discuss societal issues that have potential implications for mental health and emotional well-being. My guests include thought leaders from both within the discipline of psychiatry and beyond. Beyond Madness is brought to you in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave. Inspiring communities, one pharmacy at a time. On the 28th of July, 2022, an incident took place that beggared belief. The gang rape of eight women at an abandoned mine to the west of Johannesburg. They were young women who were shooting a music video. The film crew were robbed of equipment, money, and cell phones. At first, I wasn't sure if I could believe what I was reading. Alas, it was true. And I found myself caught up in the horror of their experience, although I had no direct connection to it. I still think about it from time to time, and the criminal case is ongoing, but not for rape. Those charges were withdrawn against the 14 alleged rapists due to insufficient evidence. They will continue to be prosecuted for the contravention of the Immigration Act, as they were all foreign nationals. As will, no doubt, those young women continue to process and cope with what took place. So I decided to open with the incident in question because I wanted to provide a real-life graphic depiction of the type of trauma potentially associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, but also to highlight the threat to women in South Africa related to gender-based violence and sexual assault, and specifically issues within the South African Police Services and National Prosecuting Authority. So on today's episode, entitled Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Crime, Trauma, Justice, and Healing, I'd like to welcome Soraya Sidat and Gerard Labuschagne. Neither is a stranger to the podcast, but just to remind our audience, Soraya is a distinguished professor of psychiatry and executive head of the Department of Psychiatry at Stellenbosch University, and she holds the South African Research Chair in Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder from the Department of Science and Technology and National Research Foundation. Gerard holds two master's degrees, one in clinical psychology and the other in criminology, as well as having a degree in law, an LLB, and a PhD in psychology. For 14 years, he headed up the South African Police Service's Specialized Investigative Psychology Section and was the South African Police Service's Chief Profiler. Currently, he is a director of a company, LNS Threat Management, which specializes in threat assessment. In addition, he holds various honorary academic positions at both the University of the Witwatersrand and UNISA. And in 2021, he published the book, The Profiler Diaries from the Case Files of a Police Psychologist. So Soraya and Gerard, welcome and thank you so much for joining me. Gerard, I'm actually going to start out with you because obviously I've described an incident and the question that came to mind at the time, and obviously I have you in front of me now as somebody who specializes in threat assessment. What about threat assessment under the circumstances? Within the context of that. And here I'm not wanting to apportion blame or liability. I'm just looking at the concept of threat assessment, and I'm looking at that context.
Well, and I don't know if this is exactly what you're asking for, but I mean, I've known about this case, you know, I think as long as everybody else has when they heard it in the media.
Yes.
My first questions were, you know, as a production company, if you're going to go out to a mine dump and have a production, where was your risk assessment?
Right.
You know, you should have had, me personally, I mean, yes, we blame obviously those men that came out and raped those women.
Sure, those are the perpetrators.
But I think if you, as an employer, let's look at it from that point of view. You, the production company, was the employer of those ladies to come there and provide a particular service to whatever you're doing.
Yes.
And you should obviously make sure there's a secure and safe environment for those people. And who would think going to a mine dump is a safe place to take a bunch of women and a lot of valuable equipment, and you don't have any, at least any security if you deem that's a good place to go and actually have your. So I think from a risk assessment point of view, that company should be held legally, if anything, civilly liable for what happened on that particular day.
So that was something that was particularly troubling to me when I'd read the story, and obviously, yeah. I don't know the specifics. We don't know the specifics. And I think one of the issues here is and it'll come up a little bit later, the issue of the rape victim and the issue of blame. And I think that is something, and so that's why I'm very specific. I'm not apportioning blame. Mm. I'm just looking at the circumstances, because for me, this was a devastating event, and could it have been prevented? Mm. Could it have been mitigated? Because I think that is obviously something that comes to mind. But, you know, you've worked with serial killers, some of whom might well have committed sexual assault. And I'm trying to get into the head, the mindset of the perpetrator under these circumstances. I mean, what goes on? What gives? Is this just a crime of opportunity? What is this all about?
You know, I'd have to say that, I mean, I doubt these offenders would have known that this team was going to be pitching up on that day.
Yeah.
So I think it was, for them, an opportunistic crime. I don't think that means that they've never ever thought about raping people or probably have raped people before. I don't think rape is a crime you ever do just once.
Right.
And you try it out and you go, oh, that was not for me. I'll move on to something else.
Right.
I think it comes with that mindset, that power control issues, dominance over your people, etc. So, and as I understand, these were illegal miners who operated in the area. So you already have people who are involved in a criminal underworld. Right. I mean, if you ever see any documentaries about that, it's a whole world on its own, the sort of Zama-Zama phenomenon. So, you know, they would have to be people that are already, this is in their frame of reference.
Right.
Because, as I said, if you come across a bunch of women, who normally just thinks, oh, I'm going to rape a woman when I see them? Mm. So there must have been that already underlying idea that this is something that's okay to do.
Yes.
And wow, here today is a fantastic opportunity. We can rob and rape.
Right. So, Soraya, we've kind of set the scene in terms of an event. We've looked at some of the issues around that, which we might well come back to. But obviously the issue of trauma and the issue of stress. So I want to come to the definition of either of those terms, because I think that they're frequently used, and I think we always need to be very clear what we're talking about when we use those words. I mean, I've been recently reading Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal. It's got a subtitle as well. And I liked the way in which he conceptualizes trauma, and I've mentioned it on a previous podcast before, the meaning being a wound, which comes from the Greek derivation of the word. And in this instance, we're talking about a psychic wound. But your thoughts on the meaning of trauma, and what is it actually?
I think the distinction between trauma and stress is a contentious one. But if we look at psychiatric nosology and the way in which trauma and traumatic events are defined in our nomenclature, so the DSM-5 specifically, traumatic events are really considered to be life-threatening events, either directly experienced or witnessed. Whereas stressful events tend to be non-life-threatening events and everyday occurrences, so more or less sort of life stresses that individuals experience on an ongoing basis. Not to say that traumatic events cannot be continuous and ongoing experiences either. And sometimes, you know, these sort of definitions are blurred, because often in the context of trauma, an individual will experience, you know, everyday stresses, and a life-threatening traumatic event does put an individual at risk of other life stresses, especially sort of responding to life stresses occasionally in a way that is, you know, maladaptive.
Right. So I've always kind of thought about trauma as something that is experienced in response to a catastrophic event. So the abnormal, the unusual. But in fact, coming back to Mate, he says, no. He says he feels trauma is far more pervasive, and someone who hasn't experienced trauma is something of an outlier. So I kind of questioned that, but then I came across the World Health Organization's World Mental Health Surveys, where they state that 70% of the global population report exposure to at least one traumatic event, which kind of suggests that it's far more pervasive and frequent than I would have imagined. But I'd always thought of it as something which is a high impact stressor. It overwhelms the individual's ability to cope, and it disrupts their relationship with self and others. So that's how I'm thinking of trauma. Am I maybe diminishing other forms of what could be conceived as trauma? Is it a subjective experience, or does it have to be objectively something that is high impact?
Well, interestingly, to go back to the DSM-5, the subjective experience of trauma has been omitted. So the subjective response to a traumatic event has been omitted as a necessary criterion for the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder in DSM-5. But I do agree with you that, you know, traumatic events typically are fairly catastrophic events that are high impact events. Yes. And they overwhelm the capacity of an individual either at the time or sometime into the future in terms of, you know, adaptively responding to the experience. And I think, you know, at a biological level, we can think about a traumatic event as causing a major disruption in biological systems, especially those systems that mediate or are implicit in the stress response. So they overwhelm the capacity of an individual to respond either at the time or sometime into the future.
So you see, for me, it's just a concern that we have a term that's overused. And I think that if we overuse something, we tend to diminish it. And it's always a concern that then we lose the individuals who may really require higher levels of intervention and care. So I think it's always very important to understand what we mean when we talk about a trauma. And I suppose it's potentially on a spectrum of experience and consequence. So one is always looking at it within the context of the individual without necessarily saying it doesn't meet the definition of a high impact stressor or a high impact event, and therefore this can't be PTSD. That's how
Yes, I would concur with that.
Yeah, so I think it's very much context specific. And again, you know, this issue of the use of the word stress. I mean, you know, changing and challenging circumstances tend to cause stress. And I mean, a lot of people, you know, find contemporary society very stressful. There's a lot of stress, but obviously trauma is such a stress. So the link between trauma and stress, I think, is very clear, which then kind of brings me to, you've mentioned the DSM-5. Apparently, we've got a text revision now, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and this whole issue of trauma and stress-related disorders. So for me, the kind of big two are acute stress disorder, but obviously post-traumatic stress disorder. Do you want to, because for me, acute stress disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder are kind of on a continuum in terms of time. So acute stress disorder within the first 30 days after an event, post-traumatic stress disorder after 30 days, but they seem broadly similar. Do you want to just maybe comment on the symptoms, how they are characterized in terms of what constitutes these disorders?
So they are similar, and I think the main distinction relates to the timing in relation to the traumatic experience. So historically, it has always been thought that acute stress disorder would be important to determine in an individual, to assess an individual soon after trauma, to determine whether they do in fact have the sort of dysfunctional response that would meet criteria for acute stress disorder, because that might predict the persistence of symptoms and the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. But what the data have shown is that acute stress disorder is in fact not a very good predictor of the persistence of symptoms. You know, that is important to bear in mind. I think also historically, which has not sort of borne fruit, was that it was thought that acute stress disorder was really characterized by a dominance of dissociative phenomena.
Right.
You know, depersonalization, derealization, et cetera, in the immediate aftermath of the event.
Right.
And, you know, those were sort of the dominant symptoms. But that, as I said, is really sort of not borne out. What we do know is that there is significant overlap in the presentation of acute stress disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. So essentially, acute stress disorder is a diagnosis that can be made in the immediate aftermath, within sort of 3 days of the traumatic event, up to a month. And if an individual continues to have symptoms or develop symptoms after 1 month, that meet a clinical threshold, then a diagnosis of PTSD can be made.
Right. So if one looks at the symptoms, so obviously, I mean, it's the one situation in psychiatry where we do have a cause and a consequence. We can say, well, that happened, this has arisen, because psychiatry, unfortunately, in terms of etiology, is often highly problematic. But I think in terms of PTSD or acute stress disorder, we certainly can say, yes, there was an event, here's a consequence. And just to be clear, that in terms of the development of PTSD, it's a small percentage you would actually move on to develop these disorders after such an event. But if one looks at the symptomatology, how would you characterize it, Soraya, in terms of what would the primary symptoms be, let's just say, of post-traumatic stress disorder, accepting that one can manifest similar in acute stress disorder?
So typically individuals will have different sort of clusters of symptoms. We can categorize them as sort of occurring in buckets or, you know, clusters. So intrusive symptoms are very common.
Right.
They relate to intrusive memories and thoughts of the experience. Vivid dreams, including nightmares, flashbacks of the event. And together with these sorts of symptoms, individual often will avoid reminders of the traumatic event. They will avoid places and people that trigger memories of the event. They will experience feelings of detachment and social withdrawal. Mm. They may have depressed mood, and you know, sometimes that makes the distinction between post-traumatic stress and mood dysregulation, major depressive disorder, for example, complicated. In addition, you know, individuals will have sort of cognitive alterations, often sort of distortions in the way they sort of think about the event and recall and replay the event. And we'll also have, you know, an elevated sort of physiological response that we sort of typically characterized in terms of the hypervigilance and the exaggerated startle, being very jumpy at reminders of the event or any stimuli that may be paired by the individual with that horrible experience.
Right. And I think that the other issue, of course, is that the issue of dissociation is quite important in terms of saying it either occurs with or without. And you mentioned earlier depersonalization. So here we're talking about an altered sense of self in a way, and derealization, where your relationship to the environment is also kind of disturbed and experienced in a way that is not normal. So you're kind of disconnected in a sense. So these dissociative phenomena. So I think that why it was important for me to really go through this is because, you know, again, the term PTSD is used very loosely. Got PTSD, features of PTSD. And I think what's very important is that it's a clinical diagnosis and they're very specific clinical features. And I think obviously that's what we want to be clear in terms of when we use that term, that's what we're talking about. So having defined PTSD and stress-related disorders with ASD, I wanted to move on to prevalence, but I wanted to bring Gerard in here because, Gerard, you obviously have worked with victims of crime in supporting and being involved with. I mean, what's your experience of PTSD as we've described it amongst folk that you have worked with?
You know, I was recently interviewing about 8 ladies who was the victim of a guy who was essentially a serial rapist. And I mean, these ladies were raped.
Not the same 8 we're talking about. This is different.
Yeah, different. Right. Yeah, individual periods in time, etc. And these are anything from 9 years ago to 15 years ago. And I was interviewing them all over the past 3 weeks. And they all still have very strong sort of, I just say, trauma symptoms from what happened. You know, right. That it impacts on their relationships. It impacts, of course, their sex lives. They still have bad dreams about what happened. You know, if they get into a situation where they don't feel comfortable and safe around a male person, they start to have the sort of bodily kind of reaction. So, you know, and I think there's certain types of trauma are in a way maybe easier to get over, if I can put it very simplistically. I think even if you're in a robbery, it's almost like maybe you can compartmentalize it. But if you have, for example, if you're the victim of a sex crime,
right.
you know you have sex as part of most normal adults consenting relationships.
Yes.
And they say, you know, when I'm with my partner, my husband, you know, I don't feel connected. I feel like this is happening to me again. So I think it's one of those types of crimes where if we have trauma as a result thereof, which you probably would have some level of trauma,
right.
It relives at various phases in your life.
Yes.
When you start a new relationship, you wonder, how's it going to be with this person? Do I tell him about what happened to me? Do I don't tell him about what happened to me? What will the first sexual experience be like? How will I react? So I think it relives itself at various points in time. And I think that's, for me, with sexual crime or sexual trauma, it's so difficult to just, in a way, to put it very simplistically, put it behind you.
No, I think because, as you're saying, you know, human sexuality, I mean, that's part of what we are.
Mm.
That's who we are. And so, therefore, this may well recur. But I'm just curious, of these women that you interviewed, how many had ever been, because, I mean, what you're describing is that they've got ongoing symptoms of what would potentially be PTSD. How many had ever been diagnosed? How many had received treatment? Because that speaks to something else that I'm going to get to as we go into prevalence and looking at consequences.
I think out of all these, I think one had ever gone for professional help. Most of them, because they don't feel they have access. They come from very sort of impoverished communities, and they're saying, where can I go? You know, and I would say the general things, you know, perhaps a local clinic that should be able to offer these services. One is near Kharankua, so there's, you know, the old Madunsa,
yes.
I think might have an outreach program. You know, those aren't the best, but if that's what's available, that's what's available to you. But, you know, most of these people could not afford to go see psychologists or psychiatrists, unfortunately.
So we have women who've been violated, who live with the consequences and are not able to access care, or maybe don't even consider that it's an option.
And I would say struggle with the consequences, you know, because it just pops up in so many aspects of their lives.
Right. Soraya, I came across in November 2021, you gave the Alan J. Fleischer Memorial Lecture. And I think the title of that lecture, and I'm not going to hold you to giving me an account of that lecture, because I know you give a lot of lectures, but it was Scars That Run Deep, Pervasive and Pathogenic Impact of Trauma and PTSD. And I mean, that title really struck me. And I'm listening to what Gerard is saying now, and I'm coming to the title of your lecture. Profound, actually. And just the essence of the title. What was the essence of your lecture, actually, if you can remember?
I do remember. The essence of that lecture was, you know, around the pervasive impact of traumatic experiences during childhood, and the substantial health challenges that individuals exposed to childhood abuse and other forms of maltreatment are at risk of as they, you know, develop into adolescence and adulthood. So, you know, the lifespan impact of traumatic experiences early in life,
right,
on the, you know, neurodevelopmental trajectories
right.
of people. And, you know, there is very robust evidence internationally, and this comes from many different contexts, showing a very sort of clear association between early childhood abuse and a number of physical and mental health outcomes. But the pathogenic aspects of that talk that I delved into were around, you know, the converging influences of biology and environment,
right.
Genetic and epigenetic, and other social determinants that, you know, come into play when someone who is exposed to childhood maltreatment, you know, experiences distress and maladjustment. So, you know, what is it that really is toxic and results in, you know, what are the factors that result in that person developing psychiatric and medical morbidity?
Well, certainly I think that the issue of adverse childhood experiences is becoming increasingly prominent as we begin to kind of look at consequences later in life and in adult life, including somatization, a lot of the somatic disorders have their origins in some or other form of trauma. But I wanted to just touch on, but thanks for just clarifying that, because I think it's very important. And I come back to the title, Scars That Run Deep. And I think for me, that's really a powerful image in my mind as I read those words. But just looking at prevalence, how common is post-traumatic stress disorder? And I know, Saraya, you were a co-author on an article, National and Regional Prevalence of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder in Sub-Saharan Africa. It was a systematic review and meta-analysis. And in conflicts, now you differentiated in areas where there was conflict, as in war or civil disruption, I would imagine, or where there wasn't. And certainly in conflict, unexposed regions, the sort of prevalence of probable PTSD was 8%. And that's just to put it in context, the worldwide figure is about 4%. So certainly elevated. And when you moved into conflict exposed regions, you suddenly got up to 30%. So certainly conflict seems to be a major driver in terms of probable PTSD. But even where there is no conflict, there is certainly an overrepresentation of PTSD as a diagnostic entity. And what was interesting is that there was no difference, significant difference, certainly between men and women. But when we get into sub-Saharan Africa, issues of intimate partner violence and non-partner sexual violence, I mean, those are very powerful mediators. And this whole issue of violence in sub-Saharan Africa, and we're going to get into South Africa in terms of some of the data, but just before I ask you to comment, I came across a 1993 study, Americans, called the National Women's Study. And what they said there, one-third of rape victims develop PTSD sometimes during their lifetime, and rape victims were 6.2 times more likely to develop PTSD than women who had never been victims of crime. So there is no question that sexual violence seems to have a very, understandably, very specific implications for the victim. But what is it about sub-Saharan Africa and sexual violence and intimate partner violence? I don't know that you have an explanation for me, but it's very striking. And in terms of the PTSD rates that are prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa, Saraya, your comments, because obviously you pooled all that data together and you were looking at it. What sense did you make of it?
So, you know, I think those data are very striking, but unsurprising, because, you know, we know that our continent is a continent that is characterized by violence, in particular sort of childhood exposure to violence and intimate partner violence. In South Africa, we have the highest rate of intimate partner violence globally.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there are many sort of socio-political factors that contribute to the much higher rates of violence, and these two specific forms of interpersonal violence on the African continent. So, you know, I think it is a sort of very complex issue. I want to highlight that the finding of sort of no sex difference is surprising on the African continent, because most studies comparing the rates of PTSD by gender have shown that, you know, women have at least a twofold higher risk of PTSD.
Yeah.
I think what you pointed out, which is really important to bear in mind, and, you know, I kind of circle back to the case study, the real case study that you presented at the outset, is that we need to remember that, you know, while the rate of PTSD in the general population is around 4 to 6%, when an individual, a man or woman, is exposed to rape, you know, rape becomes highly pathogenic as an experience for PTSD. And so, as you mentioned, you know, about 40% of women who are raped go on to develop PTSD. And that statistic actually mirrors data from South Africa.
Okay.
And so I think we need to bear that in mind, that we need to have a very high index of suspicion as clinicians, as people, you know, working with rape survivors, that the risk of developing PTSD is much higher than other forms of interpersonal violence.
Absolutely. And I think I'm just going to put a few numbers to that because I came across the stats from 2019-2020. So 42,289 reported rapes, 7,749 sexual assaults. So let's put that together. That's about 50,000 women who've been violated sexually. Now, to just compound that, one in nine is reported, which means eight out of nine are not reported. So now I'm extrapolating that 50,000 and saying, well, there's many times more potential victims. Then I put into the mix this issue that one third of rape victims will develop PTSD sometime during their lifetime. And you start to kind of do the maths on that number. And it's staggering, actually, because this is happening annually. This is not like a one-off event. And so that's the number. And, you know, once you start to get your head around that, or maybe you struggle to get your head around that, because that's a lot of people, women, walking around, not exclusively women, because it does, you know, sexual violence can happen to men as well, but it's predominantly women. And you're thinking, wow, where are all these people? What is going on with them? And how many of them who suffer are not receiving any intervention? And what are the consequences of this chronically unaddressed trauma that they've experienced? So, I mean, you know, when I start to look at the numbers and I start to do the maths, I'm taken aback. So, Saraya, I don't know what your thoughts are there, but I'm actually just sort of looking at numbers and saying, wow.
You know, I think that the data are staggering, and it is hugely concerning we have a situation, and in a situation in South Africa that doesn't seem to have shifted much over time, where, you know, the reporting of rapes is a major challenge.
Yes.
Early intervention is a major challenge. And, you know, we think about PTSD, but there's so many other mental health sequelae as well as physical health sequelae.
Yes.
In our country, you know, HIV,
incidence,
the risk of HIV following rape is a major concern, especially if a woman does not report the rape. You know, I kind of wonder how many individuals there are, you know, who have become infected post-rape, who are unaware that they have been infected. So it is very, very concerning. And I think it also speaks to the support that women who do report rape receive, because often that is perceived as sort of unsatisfactory, stigmatizing.
Yes.
There's often sort of lack of follow-up, follow-through on care. So I think there are many challenges that we face. At the same time, I think it's, you know, very positive that in our country we do have these rape care centers. That are national rape centers that do provide a one-stop shop,
yes,
if you will, to you know, women and men who have been, and children, adolescents who've been sexually assaulted.
I think what is really daunting for the victim is moving it through the system. And I'm going to flip to Gerard there, because the other statistic, 14% of perpetrators of rape are convicted in South Africa, which means that 86% are not. And so how many potential rapists are there in our midst who have not been convicted, found guilty? Maybe there could be some false accusations, I don't know. But the truth of the matter is 14%. And I think, Saraya, the issue of there being a one-stop shop, which is great, because I think the people who, you know, staff those centers, I think really know their stuff, and they get, you know, very involved with the victims. But in terms of individuals that I've encountered, it's the thought of then going through the legal process, where it's like you're going to have to go to court. Everything is going to be made public. You're going to have to defend yourself, actually, because The perpetrator is innocent until proven guilty. So you're actually going to relive the entire situation. And how many people, women, are specifically comfortable to do that? And I think just before I bring you in, Gerard, just coming back to that National Women's Study from 1993 in America, issues for victims, blame, the family or non-family finding out, identity being revealed by the media. And guess what? I think with the Krugersdorp situation, that's exactly mm-hmm. what did happen.
Yep.
Never mind the fact that there was theft of a cell phone by one of the SAPS members of one of the victims. Pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and of course, stigma. So those are some of the issues for women from that National Women's Study. But your comments on this issue of perpetrators and 14% being found.
Well, we did, yes. I say we, it was a huge bunch of us, mainly from the Medical Research Council, did a nationally representative study of rape attrition. So for the moment a case is opened,
right.
where does it fall out or where does it end up? So it's a nationally representative sample. And from this study, essentially, no, we're only talking about the cases that actually made it to the police station to be reported now.
Right.
Okay, so as we know, I think I heard the last stats were like 1 in 20 only get reported.
Okay, so I've got 1 in 9, that's on the low side.
So in this particular study, 57% of the cases an arrest was made.
Okay.
All right, out of the total sample, 34% were prosecuted.
Right.
So about a third of cases brought to the police's attention get prosecuted. 8.6% of all cases brought to the police's attention end up with a conviction.
Okay, so I've got 14%, which is on the high side.
So this particular study. So it's not great. So you know that there's less than a 10% chance that if I go to the cops, that I'll end up with a conviction, even if they identify the person.
Right.
And the majority of these cases fall out essentially in the police investigation phase, that they either don't find someone, et cetera. So one of the biggest areas of problem is actually the policing part of it.
And I suppose that's what I wanted to highlight, is the fact that for the victim, that kind of data, whether they know the actual numbers, but intuitively, they're looking at a situation and saying, what is the likelihood? What are the chances? So I know that in the title of the podcast today, I put in the word justice, but I put it there specifically. Because I don't know that there is justice. And I think the fact that there isn't justice for the vast majority of victims creates a situation where actually following through is incredibly difficult at the end of the day. And so for me, you know, we've got policies in place, we have laws, we have institutions, but to what end? Because ultimately, when you have numbers like that, how is all of that serving the victim?
And I also want to point out, you know, we who live in the suburbs, we are only now, I say now in the past year or two, feeling like, oh, this policing is terrible and we're not safe. I can tell you people living in impoverished circumstances for decades have not felt that there's policing for them.
Yes.
So that, you know, people who get raped, who are staying in informal settlements, they don't think there's ever going to be justice. That's probably, and also why they don't go report most of the time.
Right.
So I think, you know, there's also, the rest of us are only catching up now at realizing actually that there is not actually policing and justice in our country anymore. And in the next 10 years, I can almost guarantee you it's going to be, there's going to be nothing. So, you know, the large majority of our country are living in not so great circumstances. So they've known for years that there's no justice. So yeah. Reporting these things to the police is very often a pointless exercise.
You know, it's profoundly disturbing, actually, having these conversations. But there's a reason why I want to have this conversation, because I think it's important that we do have this conversation, because we've got to put it out there. But, you know, Soraya, coming back now to the issue of treatment, and I think one of the issues is the so-called treatment gap. And I think that for mental disorders generally, there's a massive treatment gap in low-income countries. Your comments on that, because I think that, you know, we've got high prevalence, low access to care, because that's really, if you just want to elaborate a little bit on the treatment gap, and let's talk about PTSD specifically in terms of treatment.
So we don't have good data in South Africa on the treatment gap for PTSD, but we know that the treatment gap in the public health sector for mental disorders generally is around 90% in the country.
So let's just repeat that, 90%. So what that means is 90% of people who have a need will not have that need met.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's an astounding.
It is. That's why I've kind of emphasized it again. I mean, it's just incredible, actually, when you think about it. So sorry, I've jumped in there because it's just you know, had to emphasize it. Carry on, Soraya.
And with PTSD specifically, you know, as you've highlighted some of the barriers to accessing care, especially among women and men who've experienced sexual assault and rape in particular, it is plausible that the treatment gap is even wider than other common mental disorders, such as depression and other anxiety conditions.
Yes.
And so, you know, the question is, you know, how do we actually get people who need the care for a post-traumatic stress disorder to access treatment? And I think this is, you know, a big challenge, and it requires a multi-pronged approach because I think, you know, it starts with universal measures where we raise awareness about post-traumatic stress disorder, about its negative impacts on the body and brain for the person who has experienced this terrible traumatic event, and that we, you know, we make it easier for people to access our services, especially in the public health sector, and you know that will start with accessing your closest primary care clinic. And then, you know, it does require education of health professionals because I think many medical professionals and other, you know, paraprofessionals who see these individuals, you know, as the sort of first point of contact, have not really received the training to provide the supportive measures and to inquire and assess individuals, inquire about and assess individuals who've been exposed, you know, to a traumatic event in that sort of immediate aftermath.
Right.
And so I think, you know, we think about doctors, it really requires education early on at medical school, teaching medical students and giving them exposure to you know, women who have been raped and giving them the skills, imparting the skills to assess, to screen, to manage, you know, a person who is recently traumatized.
And I think that's really the issue is putting, and that's why I say I think this conversation is very important, because we're putting it on the table and we're saying there are very specific sensitivities and skills that are potentially required in order to enable a victim to come forward, to be appropriately understood, processed, moved through the system, and walked through the system. Because I think we're dealing with people who've been traumatized, they're vulnerable, and so there needs to be an extra awareness of that in order to walk them through the system to get them to the point where they might be in a better position to say, I'm going to follow through in terms of prosecution of the individual who violated me. So just looking at PTSD generally, I mean, in terms of treatment, if we take a biopsychosocial approach, I mean, from a pharmacological point of view, the kind of standard interventions would involve use of various antidepressant agents or anxiety-relieving agents or medications to help one sleep. Soraya, your comments in that sense?
Yes. So with regards to medication treatments, the first-line interventions are the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and the serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors.
Yeah.
There are, in fact, only two medications that have FDA indications for PTSD, and this may be surprising.
So FDA, just to jump in, FDA is the American Regulatory Authority, Federal Drug Administration. Sorry, carry on, Soraya.
Yes, the Food and Drug Administration.
Food and Drug Administration, that's it.
Yes, so fluoxetine is not registered for traumatic stress disorder, but it is certainly in the Western Cape, I think, the most widely available SSRI, and you know, the oldest SSRI that we have available. So the two medications that are FDA registered or indicated for post-traumatic stress disorder are sertraline and paroxetine.
Right.
And all other medications that we use, antidepressants as well as you know, other anti-anxiety agents and mood stabilizers are used off-label.
Right.
Most treatment guidelines will recommend psychotherapy as a first-line intervention. And yes. I think, you know, this poses a challenge, as you know.
I was going to say, if you can access it.
Yes, if you can access it. So I think, you know, there is a human resource challenge. We have few clinical psychologists, relatively few in the public health sector in terms of, you know, psychologist to population ratio. And we need to bear in mind that there are often sort of long waits for our patients to see a clinical psychologist, to receive some trauma-focused intervention.
Right.
Because trauma-focused interventions actually have the best evidence for efficacy in post-traumatic stress disorder. And so, you know, it's often sort of anxiety that a psychiatrist or other medical practitioner has about starting treatment as soon as possible and resorting to a medication prescription for a patient. And medications and trauma-focused interventions are both very effective.
So I mean, I know sort of in my exposure, a good night's sleep is always very important. And certainly if you've got those intrusive nightmares that keep waking you up, obviously the hypnotics, those things that help you sleep, and obviously the anxiety that goes with it. So certainly there's a pharmacological possibility in terms of treatment, psychotherapy, if you can access it, very important. But this issue of memory, which I think is really quite an important central concept in post-traumatic stress disorder, the traumatic memory, how to shift it and how to prevent it consolidating. Is there anything that's kind of cutting edge or developing around what one can do about those memories beyond, you know, the SSRIs, hypnotics, anxiolytics, and what have you? Your thoughts on that, Saraya?
Well, yes, there is. You know, many of the trauma-focused interventions are being investigated. So there's more sort of a deeper dive into investigating the mechanisms by which these trauma-focused interventions work on fear and memory extinction in post-traumatic stress disorder. But there are a number of other newer interventions. For example, you know, virtual reality exposure therapy and investigating its effects on fear and memory extinction. And then newer sort of pharmacotherapies, a lot of interest in the psychedelics.
Yes, I was going to ask you about MDMA, good old ecstasy, as one of them, for example.
Yes, and so MDMA has multiple sort of mechanisms of action, or is thought to have multiple mechanisms of action in PTSD. And, you know, the benefits in PTSD, which have been shown because there have been a few trials, and it is very likely that MDMA will be the first psychedelic compound registered by the FDA.
Right.
Because it has received sort of breakthrough therapy status to be fast-tracked through clinical trials, but it is very likely that it will soon receive approval for PTSD. And one of its mechanisms of action is thought to be sort of fear extinction and its effects on sort of synaptogenesis and synaptic plasticity
yes.
in the brain, and how that may sort of make memories malleable in a more beneficial way. So I think there's a lot of excitement
yes.
and traction in trying to understand better how these drugs and non-drug therapies exert their effects on fear and fear extinction.
So just to be clear, MDMA is methylene dioxymethamphetamine, just in case you wondered what the abbreviation stood for. But obviously the use of psychedelics is with accompanying psychotherapy in a safe setting. So I think there are terms and conditions, T's and C's apply in terms of, you know, utilization. But it's interesting for me how psychiatry is moving from illicit substance to therapeutic substance over time, and it keeps coming up again and again. But I want to get into the social side of things, because we're biopsychosocial. And obviously, I went to a government website looking at what the South African police services provide in terms of victim support. And I want to bring you in, Gerard, because obviously support groups, communities, networks, because I think in the immediate aftermath, you know, we're talking now pharmacotherapy, psychotherapy, but in the immediate aftermath, it's that social, the network of concerned people around you who you can trust. But when I went to the government website looking at the SAP, South African Police Services, it says, in a case of domestic violence or sexual assault, the South African Police Service will help you find medical attention, shelter, victim counseling, and they give a whole range of organizations. To what extent does that really apply? And, you know, it may vary from police station to police station.
Yeah, I think it's going to vary greatly. So you might get a police station where all three of those you have access to, and it's probably not going to be the police, it'll be NGOs.
Right.
So I couldn't say it's actually the police giving it to you. I just think it's going to vary greatly, and I think most people are not going to have access to that. And I think for me, that's what's important is that, as we heard, you know, how many psychiatrists are there? How many psychologists are there? I think the Northern Cape has like two psychiatrists. So we have to move away from thinking that that's going to be a way of dealing with people. We have to look at more at who's there. Do we need to train people? It's not the ideal, but, you know, it's better than nothing maybe.
Yes.
To be able to provide people that supportive environment, context, whether it's social workers that are more widely available, to teaching religious duomenes, pastors, preachers, to somebody, because we are not going to ever be able to reach that level of having enough experts out there to address the needs of the people.
So it would strike me that if I look at the data, if I look at the numbers, and I look at the need, we need to create at specific police stations or all police stations, the availability of those kinds of resources, not necessarily in-house sitting there all the time, but with access to. Mm. Because I do think, and I must imagine, that within the immediate aftermath of such an event, it's that kind of human contact in a safe environment where somebody will simply listen and be available to support you and guide you through the process that is the beginning of potentially the healing pathway, because what Soraya and I are talking about in terms of pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy is kind of down the line if PTSD symptoms emerge. Mm. So I'm talking about what happens in the immediate aftermath. And Soraya, to what extent does that constitute potential prevention of the development of PTSD, those kind of initial availability of resources to listen and to compassionately assist the person process what they're experiencing, what they've been through, and to walk them through this whole process, which, you know, if one thinks about the kind of forensic examination that needs to take place, it's a pretty intrusive process in its own right, these sort of swabs and the gathering of samples and information. So, Soraya, your thoughts on that kind of initial, because we always talk biopsychosocial, but now I'm flipping it and I'm saying, I think we start with the social, because maybe that is maybe a more powerful way of preventing what might emerge subsequently. Your thoughts on that?
So that would constitute secondary prevention.
Right.
After the traumatic event and providing just early care and support. And so very basic psychological first aid can be beneficial.
Yes.
And can be provided by, a relatively unskilled individual.
Yes.
So psychological first aid, has really been tested and tried in the context of large mass disasters, particularly sort of natural disasters or other man-made disasters. But it is an intervention that can be provided and really is, as I said, very basic support, providing emotional support, attending to the basic needs of the individual in the immediate aftermath of a traumatic event. Typically, in that period, we do not deliver specific interventions,
yes,
such as medications. I mean, right, they should be avoided at all costs. You should really allow for some natural recovery following the traumatic event.
Yes.
And even non-medication interventions, such as trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy or other trauma-focused interventions, should not be administered right away. One should actually sort of have this waiting and monitoring period
yeah.
of around 2 to 3 weeks before making any decision about a more formal intervention. Yes.
So I think that's really where I'm coming from. I think that in the immediate aftermath, I think what the person needs is to feel safe. They've been violated, they've been abused, and so they need to feel safe. And this idea, for example, with PTSD, that one needs to immediately debrief, I think we've got to be very careful about that because it can lead to worsening. And it's not necessary to debrief because, I mean, the data that I've seen suggests that those who don't debrief are as psychologically healthy as those who do. And I think that each individual speaks as much as they are comfortable with. So we're coming to the end of our time, but I have to ask the question, and I don't expect an answer now. But it seems to me there is something profoundly wrong with our society. I mean, the extent of violation is just, as we were saying earlier, Soraya, I mean, you know, it's kind of jaw-dropping. So we've got laws, we've got policies, we've got institutions. But at the end of the day, it's people who make up society. And what is it with our society specifically that is producing these numbers? So as I say, I don't expect an answer, but Gerard, your thoughts and Soraya in closing. Because I think ultimately sure. that, you know, when we talk about prevention, it shouldn't be happening. Mm. That's the issue for me. So your thoughts, Gerard, and then Soraya.
Yeah, I mean, as for the cause, I mean, I've worked on so many cases and I still can't figure out why people end up doing the things they do. I do know what's not helping, and that is if there are not consequences for your behavior,
right,
it just makes it easier for people to consider to do these things.
So we need to look at the entire system. Soraya? Mm. I know it's a tough question, and I don't expect you to say, well, here's the answer.
Yeah. Well, what I'm going to say, I think, is, you know, very sort of lofty goal. But I do think we need to sort of go back to what are the primary drivers. And here I think about all of the social determinants.
Yes.
And the convergence of social determinants, because I think if we really want to reduce trauma and violence in particular in our context, we need to address all of the social determinants.
Yeah.
That's much easier said than done.
No, sure.
Poverty, food insecurity,
yes.
You know, lack of education, lack of access to just primary health care services.
So I think that's very important. You've mentioned social determinants of health and mental health. And it brings me to the issue of biopsychosocial and social psychiatry, which I think is something which maybe we've lost a little bit in the pursuit of the biological. And I think when we look at these social determinants, it brings us back to that. So, Soraya and Gerard, I want to thank you for your time and expertise and willingness to join this conversation. It's a very difficult one, but I think a very important one. So in closing, you know, what words of comfort can one offer for victims that is not trite or potentially insensitive? So as a clinician, maybe I'll quote myself from an Instagram page that I have called Alice and the Prof. Well, it's Alice and the Prof. And Alice had sent me an image of hands holding each other, two hands. And my immediate response to that was, from a therapeutic point of view, I can't walk in your shoes, but I can hold your hand. And that seems to echo what prominent American psychiatrist Alan Francis had to say about healing in relation to psychotherapy. It's the relationship that heals more than the technique. So I will leave you with that thought.
This has been Beyond Madness, in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave, inspiring communities one pharmacy at a time. Remember, there is no health without mental health, and until next time, take care.